time, it's 1:00. With us today, Representative Gutenberg, Representative Faircloth, thank you for being here, the first meeting of the year. Not your first meeting, but the first one here, appreciate you being here. Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson, Rosas, and Kawasaki. Before us today is HB 267, and I have recused myself from presenting the bill since the co-chair is not here, and will ask my staff to present the bill. I would like to remind everyone to turn their cell phones off in advance, take your gum out of your pocket, and we've been joined by Representative Edgman. With that, if you'd introduce yourself for the record and begin.
My name is Jeannie Osnes. I'm staff to Representative Craig Johnson. And House Bill 267, Wildlife Violator Compact, is a bill that allows the state of Alaska to become partner with 26 states that are currently in the compact, and Ohio will become part of the compact this month. This basically allows us to work with these other states. If we have a violator who's lost his license here, he's lost his license, he or she has lost his license in the other 26 states, so it's reciprocal. It's the same, they've lost their license in Missouri, they can't come up here and hunt or fish either. We have online with us Alan Kane. He is a law enforcement specialist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And we also have Burke Waldron with the Alaska State Troopers here to go through the bill and explain it to you. If you'll open your packet to the second part, you'll see the map showing the states that are either in the process or are in the compact. Al Kane is in Kodiak at the Board of Fish presenting there, and he has gone over to the LIO in Kodiak, and so he will be speaking to the slides as I move them through, and he would like to have you ask your questions as you see something as the slide is going by. It makes it a little simpler than since he can't see here.
Any questions for the sponsor's representative before we start taking some testimony? Thank you. Jeannie, you're going to go with Al first?
Yes.
Okay. Al, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Al Kane. I'm the statewide law enforcement specialist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I finished a 25-year career with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, and for 5 years have been with Fish and Game now. And I need to apologize. I'm very, very excited at this moment. I've been working for about 10 years to arrive at this particular moment in history, and this is quite an opportunity. I was presented with a slideshow several years ago by Rob Buonamici, who was at that time the administrator for the Wildlife Violators Compact in the United States, and we have a version of that here to present you, to familiarize you with what the concept is here today. So I'll just say next slide, Ms. Austin, and if you could advance those, please do. So go ahead to slide two, please.
Slide two.
A little bit of history here. The Wildlife Violators Compact was patterned after the driver's license compact, which all the states at this point have entered into. In essence, if you're revoked, your driver's license is revoked in one state in the United States, you can't just go to another state and get another license and begin driving. And that was the initial idea behind the Wildlife Violators Compact. It started in 1985 between Nevada and Colorado, and they finally passed legislation in 1989, also adding the state of Oregon. And then in 1991, the program began, and immediately many states recognized this would be a very, very valuable tool to deter serious wildlife violators everywhere in the nation. Next slide, please. And the reasoning for that is, and I've got seven slides here. I could probably present hundreds if we wanted to, but these are just some of the reasons. This slide shows one of the poachers, two men, were convicted of taking bighorn sheep without licenses in the state of Wyoming. They were fined $19,800 and had their hunting privileges suspended for 10 years. The problem with that is immediately they can move to another state and begin hunting there, including Alaska. So this is the big reason, is to stop the interstate travel of serious poachers. Next slide. These are just some other examples. These were two habitual wildlife violators that decided to go out on Christmas Eve, and they were convicted in the state of Wyoming for taking two bighorn rams completely out of season, animals that should not have been killed. Next slide.
Thank you.
In the state of Idaho, these individuals had killed a spike bull elk during a closed season in Idaho, then hauled it back into Montana and affixed a Montana elk tag indicating the animal was taken there. The group consisted of eight Montana residents that had been killing up to 10 bulls in Idaho during closed periods for almost 15 years, which had a real significant population impact there. Next slide. In Colorado, this individual was convicted in Arizona of several serious game violations and then was convicted of illegal guiding in the state of Colorado. Next slide. In Missouri, these individuals, or some of the game that's depicted here, the poachers were shooting deer illegally in Iowa, bringing them back to the state of Missouri to be checked in as legal kills there. And it seemed like a real good idea until they were apprehended, and it cost the group more than $20,000 in total fines. Next slide, please. This poacher is posing with four deer, three javelina, all of which were taken on one trip, completely illegally, had been poaching for years until an informant tipped him off. Next slide. This one depicts a case that I worked a few years ago. This individual in the picture, these men had flown into Black Lake north of the Iliamna, and this picture was taken the same day, in fact, almost within an hour of their landing. It was a same-day airborne violation. This was a cow caribou that was absolutely off-limits for the non-residents to take. This group had an illegal, unlicensed guide. They killed a total of 11 illegal caribou and entirely wasted the meat of nine. They left the animals whole, wasted all the meat, simply because the antlers were not big enough. We revoked their hunting licenses. We jailed them here in the state of Alaska for this serious crime. The problem was they returned right back to the state of Alabama where they were from, which is not a member of the compact, and were able to go hunting that fall season down there. If we had been a member of the compact, they would have been revoked in 26 states, which presently are members of the compact, which is the reason that we're here today. Next slide. The foundation of this entire compact, there are three main reasons that give this tremendous value. First and foremost is it prevents poachers who are revoked in any one of the member states from hunting or fishing, depending on what their violation is, in other states. The second thing is that it provides for the issuance of citations to non-residents versus having to arrest them. This is a big issue in many other states where when the wildlife authorities encounter a non-resident because of the risk of them just fleeing across state lines and not facing up to their citations, they would place them under arrest, have to stop their field patrol, immediately take them before a magistrate. That does occur in Alaska on occasion, too, and this would be a benefit for us. And it provides a tremendous deterrence for serious fish and wildlife crimes. People who know that the state of Alaska is a member of this compact would seriously have to think twice before they plan to come up to harvest game just to sell their parts or to take part in illegal guiding operations and other serious things like that. Next slide, please. what the current provisions of the Wildlife Violators Compact provide for, and I've got two slides here that show these. The first is that anyone who's revoked in one compact state can be revoked in all the compact states if the conviction is a basis for revocation in that state. And what that means is each state has the ability to screen the type of conviction and the basis for the revocation in the other state, then decide whether that meets the criteria in their state. For example, if someone were to be have their fishing license revoked for taking an unlawful perch in the state of Ohio, that would probably not be a basis for license revocation in Alaska. And our compact administrator here would probably not elect to revoke that person in Alaska. But if a person was convicted of a more serious crime, taking animals out of season, taking a number of sport-caught fish and selling them commercially, then we would opt to revoke that here. So each state has the ability to look at the revocations and make sure they meet the criteria for their own home state. The second thing is each state will treat a conviction as if it occurred in their state and be able to revoke the license based on this legislative bill, based on the language of the compact. A violator of a compact state is treated as if they're a resident. This is a tremendous benefit for the compact states, because if the non-resident flies back to their home state and doesn't take care of a citation, they can have their license revoked in all 26 states, potentially. So there's a great incentive for them to take care of citations. If the violator fails to appear, that's what FTA stands for, if they fail to appear, then the state issuing the citation would notify the home state. Next slide. And the home state would then notify the violator.
Al, just a second. We have a question here.
Sure. Riffin. You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the question was on your first bullet point there about what you talked about, suspending terms in Alaska. Who makes that determination as to whether the violation that occurred in another state is coincident enough with a violation here, or is bad enough here to revoke the license? What authority does that? Is that fish and game? Is that wildlife? Is that the courts? Where's that determination made?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. In the language in the bill there, under the compact administrator procedures, the Department of Public Safety will be the state agency administering this compact, and they would have a clerk who received the download of the most recent revocation information, and then a person would be selected in the Department of Public Safety as the compact administrator. And I believe Captain Waldron can probably address who that would be. My assumption is it would be someone of command level, probably a lieutenant or above, that would be assigned as the State of Alaska Wildlife Violator Compact Administrator, and that individual, in consultation with the director's staff in the Alaska Wildlife Troopers Division, would be the person who makes that decision of whether to revoke a person in the state of Alaska based on revocations issued outside. That's an excellent question.
A follow-up, Representative Seed.
Thank you. So just for clarification, then, it's an administrative procedure in our state, presuming this happened in the other state, like the example was of the perch. If it was five perch instead of one perch, and the administrator decided that was a significant violation or was equivalent to a violation that would require revocation in our state, the administrator would revoke the license here. That wouldn't be a court proceeding to revoke that license. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Based on the authority in the compact, when someone is revoked in another state, we can simply administratively adopt and accept that revocation based on the screening of the compact administrator. If the person lives in Alaska, if they commit a violation in Wyoming, for example, and then fly back to Alaska, and Wyoming convicts them, they would send that conviction information to us here in Alaska, and since this is where that person resides, Alaska would then notify the person, and that's when a court hearing would be involved, is in the home state of the individual.
Representative Seaton, continue.
Thank you. So just clarifying that last point one more, I think I got it. So that if it's in a violation in a compact state, then they're, before the license is revoked in the home state, there would be some kind of a judicial procedure here in Alaska as a home state. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, and one more follow-up.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And so is this the portion in the title on line two where it's authorizing the compact to supersede existing statutes? Is this the portion that we're talking about there, or is that, or does that come further in your presentation?
I believe, if I understand your question correctly, the place that authorizes due process and the court proceedings in the home state for us is on page 10 of the bill. It's in section 2. It would be an amendment to the penalty provisions there in Title 16. That's where we as a home state get the authority to revoke a license based on a conviction in another state. They have to actually be convicted in another state of something revocable, then they would tell us, and then we would take action as a home state. But somewhere in the, and I can find it here in a moment, in the compact itself in Section 1, gives us the authority that if a person, a Nevada resident, for example, is convicted and revoked in that state, it gives us the authority to simply adopt that revocation because of the compact language.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like to just highlight that I would like to get some further explanation of that part of the in the title there where it authorizing the compact to supersede existing statutes. I'd like to get a little further clarification on how far this bill goes in putting this compact above the existing statutes of the state of Alaska. So if this isn't the appropriate place, that's fine. I just want to flag it and have it answered before the end.
Thank you, Representative. We do have Kevin Saxby online. Kevin, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kawasaki, do you want to hold your question until the end of
Mr.
Kane's?
Okay.
Mr. Kane, you may go ahead.
All right. I think I can just take a real quick try at Representative Seaton's concern there. On page 3 of the bill, on about line 23 there, section E, is the language that allows the home state to recognize and treat convictions recorded for its residents, which occurred in another party state, and there's a couple of other spots too. The only superseding that I understand this bill does is when someone is convicted in another state, it gives us the authority to adopt that revocation, and then, of course, section 2, if it is the home state, if an Alaskan goes outside and does something, we would be able, and is convicted, we would be able to act upon that conviction as if it happened here, revoke the license, and then all 26 states would screen and pick that up. So I hope that helps a little bit, Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I think so. So basically what this is saying is it just is an extension of the jurisdiction or the jurisdictional boundary of where that applies. Is that, that's the superseding that we're talking about?
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. It instead of just Alaska, it allows us to adopt convictions and impose revocations based on violations in any of the compact states. So that's probably the best way of saying it. It's just the jurisdiction increase.
Thank you. Mr. Kane, go ahead, please.
On that,
all right.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. So in that case, if this legislative body had a violation before it and decided not to adopt that as a fish and game violation, but another state did, then your department could act and revoke somebody's license for something that they were convicted for in another state where we had decided that it wasn't a violation?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think I understand your question.
Okay, we have somebody here from the Department of Law.
We do have someone from the Department of Law. Do you want to ask that now?
Well, we can wait.
Okay. Mr. Kane, go ahead with your presentation.
All right, thank you. So in that case, if a person, this is the second portion of the compact, if they fail to appear in the state that issued the citation, then the home state would notify the violator that he would be suspended until the terms of the citation are complied with. And if they still refuse to comply, which a few do, the revocation information is entered into Utah's database, and then each compact state then receives a download of that information at least on a monthly basis, some more often than that, and they would enter and control their own information. Each state can access the information on all revokees in the database and sort by violation if they wish, and it allows for viewing of only those violations which are revocable in our state. Or in other words, we could put a screening process on some states who may have very, very low or different standards for revoking licenses. We could just screen those right out, sort them by violation, and view the ones that fit our criteria for revocation. Next slide, please. So the technical aspects of this, all of this data is stored in a mainframe computer, which is hosted by the Utah Department of Public Safety. And access to that mainframe is granted to the compact administrator and the law enforcement personnel here, which would reside with the Department of Public Safety with Captain Waldron's people. And then they would decide how often they wanted to receive those downloads and look at and screen the information. Next slide, please. So the downloads of violator information can be incorporated also into our drawing permits. The Department of Fish and Game would probably receive these lists just prior to finalizing drawing hunt information or registration hunt information. We would know who was revoked in the member states and be able to not issue them permits here in the state of Alaska. There on the left is a picture of one of the animals that the Alabama hunters wasted. The antlers just were not big enough there. Next slide. Now, the slideshow was put together in 2004, so some of the information on this slide may be a little bit dated and not completely accurate, but this is the information, the most current that I have. Approximately 4,000 names are currently in the database. Nearly 10,000 individuals have been revoked, and that was just through 2005 over time that cycled through the compact. About 50% are revoked due to big game violations. There are actually 26 states currently that participate in the Wildlife Violator Compact. Ohio just joined. And it takes an average about 3 minutes to do an entry by the clerical staff to manage the compact. Next slide. The next few slides just show some of the numbers here for the information of the committee. In 2003, there was a high of 1,873 people revoked. That has gone down a little bit, which I'm hoping is an indicator of people paying attention to this and this becoming more effective. Next slide. This just shows the total number of people into 2004 who were currently suspended on the list. Next slide. This is a pie chart which shows the number of revocations recorded by the member states in 2004. Next slide. This pie chart shows by percentage the type of violations, and as you can see, big game violations were by far and away the largest portion there. with fish transportation and possession violations coming in second. Next slide. This one just depicts the average age, shows you the age element of some of the hunters involved in the suspensions or revocations. Next slide. There's an annual meeting that's held, and the compact administrator would be expected to attend that to confer with the other compact administrators from other states. And they've been in the process of refining this and conferring. This is an excellent information sharing platform. Criminal activity is seriously curtailed when law enforcement agencies begin to communicate effectively. Reaching beyond state lines is an extremely effective way. Many of these poachers are very mobile. They move around. And this is just an excellent way to keep them on their toes, so to speak. Next slide. This slide does not have all the current states since this slide was put in Florida, Illinois, Kansas, Mississippi, New York, Ohio, and Tennessee have joined for a total of 26. Next slide. This slide is a little bit outdated too. Ms. Austin handed out the current picture of the United States, which should show 15 states in the process of joining the compact, which would include Alaska. Three have already passed legislation, and the other 12 are in the process, as we are, of passing it. There are 26 states who currently are members of the Wildlife Violators Compact, and there are only 9 who up to this point in time have given a stable no to joining, but we're certainly hoping to reduce those numbers, because those will probably be the only states where the poachers will know they won't get revoked in other states. Final slide, please. So just a real quick recap here. The reasons why Alaska should join, first and foremost, it greatly increases deterrence of serious fish and wildlife crime in Alaska by individuals who hunt in other states. It increases the compliance of people of non-residents who would choose to leave the state and not take care of citations that they received. It would increase compliance there because they could also be revoked until they take care of it. And of course, the overall goal here is to greater protect our valuable fish and game resources throughout the entire United States. So thank you very much for your patience. That's an overview, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kane before we hang him? You will stay on the line, won't you, Mr. Kane?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, looking back on slides where we're talking about the pie chart of the types of violations, 5% of the violations, which I guess resulted in license suspensions, came from trespassing violations. Now, would that be a category that in Alaska would not generally result in revocation of a license, or is that something that we also have for as a general class?
Representative Seaton, at this time, the state of Alaska does not have the ability to revoke a hunting or fishing license for criminal trespass. That's a Title 11 criminal jurisdiction, unless they committed a game or a fisheries violation while they were in the act of trespassing. We would screen that one out, and that would not be a revocable offense here in the state of Alaska.
And to
follow up, Representative Seaton?
Following up on that, so let's say that we have someone that, I mean, we have a lot of private land up here. So if there was someone that had a RS2, you know, a right-of-way violation going across native land or something similar to that up here, since that wouldn't have a violation that couldn't be used in the other state for revoking a hunting or fishing license, could it? I'm just trying to get the parameters around what these violations you know, how broadly or how narrowly they're focused in the compact.
my understanding of the language in the compact is that unless it's revocable in this state, it wouldn't be considered by other states. We would not begin reporting violations that were not revocable in this state.
Thank you. Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Al, two comments I guess I want to make, and one is on, well, in it's probably slide 16, but where it shows that the violations went up to a peak and then they started tapering off. Is this, this is in the compact database, so I can assume from that that if they're tapering off in the states where the compacts are, that probably our state is seeing more because it's not in the compact, and if they're going to go someplace, they're smart enough to go to a place where there's not a compact. Am I correct?
Representative Wilson, I don't have any of the statistics for the conviction pattern for the Department of Public Safety with me. Captain Waldron might be able to address that. But I do feel very strongly that serious wildlife poachers know exactly which states belong to this compact and which ones do not. And right now they would feel very free to come to Alaska. They may get caught here, they may not. But if they're today, if a license is revoked here or a hunting privilege is revoked in Alaska, it has no bearing in the other states, in the other compact states. So I do believe that information is well known in poaching circles, and that this would be a tremendous deterrent for that kind of activity in Alaska.
Okay, and follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Just one more question, I guess. Because there's a zero fiscal note on this, the compact has kind of gotten together with all the other states, I guess, and decided that when there was a their annual meeting is held at a time with another meeting that most of the states go to. I'm assuming this because the fiscal nut was zero.
Al, I can answer that. That is correct. I think it's the National Law Enforcement or Wildlife Enforcement. We have Burke Walden here who can answer that. And
yes, through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. That is
you, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, certainly. This is Captain Burke Waldron with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. I apologize for that. Again, Mr. Kane identified in his slide what the association is that, and frankly, I can't remember because there's several of them that we attend. But it is a part of a conference that Alaska usually sends a representative to. So therefore, no fiscal note for us with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative, anything else, Representative Wilson?
No, that's it.
Okay, Representative Rosas?
Just to follow up on that point, then I assume that because of the zero fiscal note that there's no cost to download the data from the Utah system?
No.
That's correct. There's no cost.
So they maintain it for free, and they provide information to Alaska as many times as we request it for free?
At this time, that's true. That's correct.
Okay. And then it's a separate question, or more of a statement than a question. I'm very supportive of the concept here, but I certainly hope people don't walk away with the impression that this stops poachers. I mean, these guys that are violating the laws as flagrantly as some of these guys did aren't going to go and bother to buy a license in the first place. This is only going to stop those that are trying to buy a license or ones that you catch in the act of doing something illegal. Then you can prosecute them in their home state, or you can prosecute them here through their home state. So it doesn't stop some of the activity. It just stops those that want to try to legally purchase a license when they've been revoked somewhere else. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, that is correct. However, the compact is a multifaceted tool, and you're correct in that some of the, you know, hardest core violators, they don't buy licenses anyway. So it will not have or will have a marginal or minimal deterrent effect on those individuals. However, the compact also provides us a tool in how we treat violators that we do catch. So, I mean, it still has a broad enough impact that it's still a valuable tool for us in other areas, though it may be have marginal effect on the hardest of violators.
Thank you. And if we could write laws that everyone obeyed, we could be out of a job very quickly. I think Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Al, on page 5 here, the definition of wildlife includes fish. And one thing I just wanted to get a little clarification on, of course, we have a lot of commercial fishing that is separate from the traditional, in many of the states, the sport fishing that is predominant. What is going to be the effect, or how does this work with the with commercial fishing violations? And is there, with this saying that the person from a non-residence can go on their way without being arrested or without having to post bond or anything else, are we in any way running a risk of high dollar amount valuation non-residents leaving in the commercial sector more than? Can you just kind of let us know how this would work in the commercial fishing industry, where you have violations that can be of high dollar amount versus the more normal sport fishing violation?
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Al Kane, again, that's another very, very good question. The compact does not deal very often with commercial fishing, and the reason for that is the numbers of commercial fishing permits and licenses that are revoked is considerably smaller than sport fishing and hunting license privileges. But the compact can be used as a tool for commercial fishing. It does not preclude it. If a person, let's say, was convicted of very serious commercial fishing offenses in Alaska and their entry permit was revoked or suspended, that would be listed on the compact website, and the other states would pick that up. And if that individual were to appear in Florida or California, they would not be allowed to purchase a commercial fishing license of a similar type, and the compact would still have the same effect. So it could be used in that arena. In my discussions with some of the other state administrators, it is not done very often. In our state, it's a very small number of revocations in the commercial fishing industry. Usually the fines are very, very high, and that's what's used as a deterrent mainly in the commercial fishing industry. But occasionally, fishing privileges are revoked. So the compact could encompass that. It deals much more often with hunting privileges and with sport fishing behind it as the largest usage.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess my concern is on page 2, section G, which is, in most instances, people cited fire violation who are from another state, you know, must post a collateral or bond or, you know, could be arrested and those kind of things. And then on page 3 under the compact, starting on line 16, that the compact would allow the violator to accept the wildlife citation, and for some subsection there, he could proceed on his way. And so is this in any way restricting the Department of Public Safety the ability to make a high value or a high potential dollar amount fine individual off the hook? Is this in any way making it so that we can't arrest the person or detain them and let them go on their way?
That's another very good question. Al Kane again. My understanding is that the wildlife troopers would still have the option in very high gravity situations to arrest an individual and have them post a bond or a bail before they're released, that option is still there. I certainly will listen to Mr. Saxby from law if he interprets it a different way, but I don't view this as tying the troopers' hands and requiring release of people at any level. This would just be the standard protocol indicated. The language there in C on line 16, allow a violator to accept it. Well, if the decision of the trooper was that it was such a high-gravity thing that arrest was indicated, I believe they still have that tool available.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to have the Department of Law give us a full detailed reading on that, and appreciate it. Thank you. That was my last question.
Thank you. Kevin, do you have anything to say about that at this point, or is it something you need to look into?
Mr. Chairman, I can address that a little bit. Can you hear me fine?
Yeah, and would you identify yourself, please?
I will. Kevin Saxby, Senior Assistant Attorney General. I've been working with the Board of Game for about 16 years now, Department of Law. If folks look in under the procedures for the issuing state, under Part A there, it says the wildlife officer may not require the person to post collateral to secure that person's appearance, subject to the exceptions set forth in down there in B, if the officer receives the person's personal recognizance that the person will comply with the terms of the citation. And then B just sets forth two criteria that must be met in order for personal recognizance to be allowed. So I think that it probably is the case that in most cases we could not require a person to post a bond if they're a member of, if they're a resident of a party state.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like, you know, at some point in time, and probably not for this hearing, could be if we move this bill on for a follow-up for Mr. Kane, who's been involved in wildlife arrests for a long time, to look at this in more detail, because I think that this situation with commercial fishing violations could be problematic if we can't allow, if we can't require the posting of a bond or something. So I think that is, I mean, I'm very supportive of the compact idea. I'm just, you know, we have a unique situation with our commercial fisheries here in the state being very expansive,
right,
more than the others. And so,
Representative Seaton, that concerns me as well. And just for the committee's knowledge, I would like to move this out today, but I do assure you the Finance Committee will look at it, and there are other options, and that concerns me as well. I don't want to be forced to let someone go who committed a serious.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, is this Kevin?
This is Al Kane.
Oh, Al, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I can address Representative Seaton's concerns just a little further. Normally, in serious commercial fishing cases, we usually do, the Department of Public Safety often does release the skipper, but the vessel and all of the fishing gear are placed under seizure. And that is usually the thing that compels them to take care of it. Occasionally in history, I can remember a skipper or two that was arrested, and it was usually for other reasons, other criminal violations other than just the fishing violation. But in very serious situations of the caliber that are being discussed here, the vessel is placed under seizure, and they put it on block, and the gear is taken, the catch is confiscated, and then those are the items that you know, come into play for the court case. So those are additional things that always enter into it in almost every commercial fishing violation.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gutenberg, I think you were next.
Thank you. Mr. Saxby, were you involved in the drafting of this legislation?
I was not.
Okay, because what I'm wondering is, you know, when I initially went through reading it, it is the section, the language of the compact looked like it's boilerplate, but it doesn't conform to our drafting procedures, and that's troubling to me. Not so much that I can't read it, but I think there's some ways that makes it very unclear that it doesn't do that, and I can just give you. on the front page, it says on page 10 that we could have adopted something that was in this form substantially as follows. I just wasn't sure because there's things in here like definitions that I don't think we have established in our statute, or, you know, we could have used other words that we actually have basis for in our law. Like you were talking about, proceed on a person's way. I'm not sure if we have a definition of that, or without delay. I don't know if actually we have legal definitions in our current statute that says that defines what those things mean. And I think the drafters probably could have taken a hand in that in. Orderly manner, collateral. There's a whole bunch of pretty nebulous statements that I'm concerned about. I mean, I support what it's doing. I think that's good. I would just like to see it tightened up a whole bunch more where it's consistent with statute.
Yep. Representative, this was drafted through Ledge Legal, so, I mean, it's not a boilerplate that we just brought in. Al Kane, I think, not Al, Brian Kane was the drafter on this.
The compact, the reason that...
Would you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry, I'm Jeannie Austin with Rep. Johnson. The reason that it is boilerplate is because all the states have the same language, minus Section 2, which we're dealing with for our state procedure. So once it becomes statute, those definitions become the definition for our statute.
Well, then, I'm sorry, but that doesn't explain it. I think that raises more questions for me than anything else, because the compact, the group can amend the compact and then change things, and we have one vote out of 26 or 27, I would remember numbers it is, but, you know, we're putting something into language that says, in most instances. Well, that doesn't sound like statute to me. You know, what is most instances? What do you define that as? I mean, I'm just concerned that the language is not clear enough and conforming enough to what the definitions that we have.
Representative Kawasaki, I believe you were next.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Kent, would you yield to Representative Faircloth? She has something on the same topic. Go ahead. Well,
I just wanted to respond to that. My understanding of agreements across borders is that the home state that originally initiated this has contractual language that they offer to other states. We accept the language, but our recourse is found in Section 2 that says all of it will be measured against state law before we actually prohibit someone or from hunting in our state. So I hear the concern, but we're buying into a larger concept, and it's my understanding we have to accept the language of the compact itself. We don't have to define it because we go into the definitions in our own court system, in our own judicial process, as we take each violator to task in our regime. So if that's not correct, I'd like further clarification on that.
Okay, thank you, and we can certainly do that. I think we can debate the merits of this a little later, but I'd like to move on with the testimony. Representative Kawasaki, I believe you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Department of Law. It's online. Dealing with the slide that we saw, under current provisions, each state will treat the conviction as if it occurred in their other state. And we're working on a bill dealing with convictions in other states and whether convicted felons or convicted people who were convicted in other states can receive a permanent fund dividend. Or if they're, and we came up with problems with the due process clause. Can you address how the compact changes the situation that we have with due process?
Kevin, I believe that was directed to you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Kevin Saxby again. The Representative Faircloth was correct. In Section 2, it does it requires that a hearing with full due process be held before any revocation can occur in this state based on revocations in other states. I hope I'm getting to Representative Kawasaki's question. Maybe I missed it.
So if there's a hearing,
Kawasaki?
Like Mr. Chairman, shouldn't there be a fiscal note?
It is not this committee's duty to prepare fiscal notes, and we've asked every department to respond and to receive none. It does have a finance referral, however, because I kind of have some questions about some of the things as well, so it does go to finance. So I'm sure they will deal with that, as always, in great depth.
And
follow-up, Representative Kawasaki?
This is actually on an earlier issue.
Another question, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rose has asked a question about whether there were already the database was already available to states who were not admitted into the compact. Is the database available?
No.
Identify yourself.
It's for the Captain Waldron, sorry. Okay.
This is Captain Waldron. No, the database is not available to us at this time.
And then a follow-up then.
Representative Kawasaki.
Yes, so, and this isn't for you, this is just in a general for licensing. So if we give a, if someone wants to apply for a license, a hunting or fishing license in the state, and I don't even remember what you have to sign, but isn't there a way that we can, without joining another compact, just administratively revoke a person from who's been a wildlife violator in another state from becoming a hunter in this state?
Certainly an option if we had that information.
And there's no other way to get it outside of this wildlife compact?
Not without a physical note.
Well, according to this bill, you probably don't need a fiscal note to do anything.
Right.
I mean,
right.
There's not even a negative fiscal note on this for what the savings are going
to
be.
As I said before, we can debate the merits of it, but I'd like to move on at this point. Did you Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to a little bit with what Representative Seaton brought up with the commercial fishermen. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of in an opposite vein that I'm thinking about this, and I don't know whether Mr. Kane or Kevin, I don't know which one of you, so after I kind of present my case, one of you would maybe respond or give me some kind of insight here. In my district this past year, and it might have been last year, I can't remember, but we had a fish tender that came from Seattle under some LLC. Came down here and hired people to work on his boat, and then didn't pay them, and I had to actually go through the labor and workforce development because it involved labor, you know. But they didn't really have any control. But what happened is he went back to Seattle, got a different LLC, and came back under a different name. Now, I don't know if, and there was not much we could do about it. So what I'm saying, in an instance like that, could this work so that we could say, hey, listen, this guy, you know, is not being fair, not conducting his business in the correct way or whatever. And could have we, because he was from a different state, we didn't have very much control over it, because by the time we went through the courts and everything, it would have cost a lot of money and everything. Is there any possibility that we could gain some positive results in that instance?
Al, let me take a stab at that. I think if they would have violated some law, a game law, then I think it would fall under what Representative Seaton said. But if it's strictly just a labor issue, this is the wrong committee, the wrong bill, the wrong everything. So I don't think it would, unless they violated a game law or some kind of law that would have allowed them to be cited in this state. So I think, Al, is that correct?
Yes, I agree.
Okay, thank you. Okay. With that, any additional questions? We will keep Mr. Kane on the line, but sitting at the table, anxiously waiting, is Burke Waldron with the Alaska State Troopers. Would you introduce yourself once again and begin your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Representative. Again, my name is Burke Waldron. I'm a captain with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. I'm here today. Again, I want to thank everybody for giving me the opportunity to speak. The Department of Public Safety and Alaska Wildlife Troopers fully support this bill. It will be an outstanding tool to put in the toolboxes of all of our wildlife enforcement troopers. You know, as I've listened to some of the questions today go back and forth, you know, I can think of some examples where it would have been helpful. Just as in this past year, I can think of a case where we had a serious multi-state poacher that came to Alaska and was responsible for the taking of two illegal doll sheep and a caribou, and I believe a moose, though I'm not certain, and his home state's Oregon, which is a compact state, and we had a $10,000 warrant for his arrest for months on end. Is that a question? No?
No, not yet.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So we had a $10,000 arrest for this, arrest warrant for this individual, and had really no teeth to our laws to enforce that. That's one aspect of the tool for us. Another aspect of the tool for us, where it comes with how we can deal with our non-residents up here. We had another situation with a non-resident assistant guide who was committing serious violations under the tutelage of a resident big game guide, and because that assistant guide was from Georgia, we were forced to arrest him before he fled the state, where we would have no means to prosecute him in the future if he chose not to return, whereas his boss, who was an Alaska resident, didn't get arrested simply because there wasn't that flight risk there. Arresting someone in the field for us is a hugely time-consuming ordeal. Typically, it involves flying them out in airplanes to get them to a local magistrate. Oftentimes, these people are flying out on weekends or late at night. Sometimes it involves that we call a local magistrate from their home to schedule an emergency hearing to arraign them so they can post their bail so they can still meet their flights and whatnot and return their lives. And many of these cases, certainly not all of them, but in many of these cases, these are for the most part honest citizens that have made an honest mistake and have to suffer more serious consequences than their resident counterpart would because they live out of state. With the assistance of this compact, we could issue those individual summonses to appear in court in the future here in Alaska. They could return home as scheduled, and if they chose not to return in the future, through a due process hearing, we could get their license revoked in 26 states, which would be, or 27 states if we join, which is a huge deterrent for most people. Certainly, as Representative Rose has brought forward, or you know, certainly not everybody, but a lot of people, and of course, the more time that we free up for our field level troopers is the more time they have to enforce the laws and catch other violators. There was a couple of questions that were brought up that I think I can help clarify. I believe Representative Seaton asked a question regarding whether our arrest authority would be diminished or taken away. If you look, I believe it's in section six on page 11. Section six is the compact administrator's manual. It's the manual that the compact administrator, you know, takes for direction. On page 11, under section B, types of violations not covered, specifically paragraph 4 says any violation that the issuing officer deems serious enough to arrest a resident violator.
Section six, second page.
Tab six.
Tab six.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
Oh,
okay. Second.
Section six.
Am I going too fast?
Yeah. And then what? The second page of section
page.
Six.
Oh.
It's in the actual compact, in the actual manual.
They just didn't get to have page numbers.
Oh, they didn't.
So it's the second page of section six.
We don't have a page number.
They're not numbered.
I only have section five.
Section five is all we got. We don't have. We don't have section six.
Section two.
Tab.
Tab six.
Tab six.
Tab six.
Tab six.
Tab
six.
That's where I am.
Sorry,
tab
two.
Six.
Page two.
Page two.
Tab six.
Page two.
Okay.
And then where are we down there?
Number four.
B four.
Bingo. I object. Everybody got their places?
Another comment I would like to make, I believe it was Representative Wilson that asked about the slide on possibly the numbers going down because they know where they can go and can't go. I personally have received calls at my desk from people from out of state who would call and ask if Alaska is a wildlife compact state before they come up here. Now, that may be for nebulous reasons. It may be because they want to know if they're allowed to or not. I don't know. But so it is known, and you know, I certainly believe is well known.
Are you finished? Before, I'd like you to relay the story of some of our most recent highly publicized case where the individual ended up back in Wasilla. If you'd relay that story, I think that's an interesting.
I started to relay part of that story already. It was interesting because it was the person who was responsible for two doll sheep, a caribou, and I believe a moose, but though I can't recall for certain right now. That individual fled to Oregon, and he also was wanted in Oregon. No, it was Washington State, I apologize. And then Washington State arrested him on drug charges as well as wildlife charges. It's kind of an interesting story because our investigative unit flew to this man's residence out of state to serve a search warrant to gain evidence that we needed to convict him. And during that search warrant, drugs, a stolen automobile, a whole bunch of other felonious activity was discovered there, and that's why he was arrested in that state. That person since has been bailed out of Washington State and opted to return to Alaska because he figured he was in less trouble in Alaska than he was in his home state of Washington, and did end up getting arrested here just a couple of weeks ago in Alaska. But the interesting part of that whole story is if he chose to, he was eligible to go get a hunting license and go hunting right here in Alaska still, because he hadn't been convicted. And though there was a warrant, if we were a member of the compact, just the fact that he had to fail to appear, he would be revoked. But we have no such authority without the compact, and so violators who are charged but not convicted because they haven't had their due process yet can continue to hunt. Through a civil due process hearing, we could have civilly revoked his privileges until his pending court case was completed. Or at least he met, not completed, until he met the requirements of that pending case.
Representative Kawasaki, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the captain, just to go back to the whether wildlife violations are online or available, are they not available through APSIN?
They are not available through APSIN. They would be available to us. What that would require that we do is when we check someone in the field, and sometimes we may check 100 people in the field a day, we'd have to write all their names down and then individually contact that person's home state, whatever the licensing agency is, and individually check on each of those people. Is this person eligible for a license? Is this person eligible for a license?
In There's the state of Alaska?
I mean, no, in their home state.
Okay.
There is law right now in Alaska that simply says if you're not eligible for a license in another state, you're not eligible here. So in some ways, that's a small part of the compact.
Right.
But the data is not readily available to us, except we'd have to, that you're asking, I believe you're asking anyway, we'd have to follow up on an individual person through a telephone call to that member state. Does that answer what you're asking?
Yeah, I guess. Couldn't...
Follow up,
Mr.
Representative
Chairman,
Kawasaki?
Couldn't, when you apply for a permit to hunt, a non-resident permit, this through Fish and Game, isn't there no screening process for, none at all?
Did Representative Kawasaki, have you applied for a hunting license lately or a fishing license?
I have.
Were you screened?
Well, I gave him my driver's license number. I think I might have given him my social security number.
Okay. I think the answer is no.
The answer is no. There is no national database that keeps track of people sport fishing and hunting license other than this compact. And that's not all states. It's only 27. Hopefully it'll be all states someday.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I had, Captain, was that if it's on a weekend, you can't do that anyway, or is there always somebody available in another state that works on the weekend, or do you have to wait then till Monday to call another state to find out something?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, no, there isn't people available. We also deal with big time zone differences at times with other states, and they don't sit by their phones on weekends and evenings in case Alaska calls to ask a question. So,
any additional questions, Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And and I, since we've been referred to this section six, I'm a little confused if maybe.
Okay.
You can, seems like the bill that we have before us that we're passing is, you know, the bill itself, has this section three, I mean, on page three says that a person can go on their way if they're agreeing to comply with terms of citation. And then we're saying that, well, we don't have to do that if we have our guidelines someplace else for the administrator that says, oh, well, we can arrest the person or we can do something else with him if the officer deems it was serious enough to arrest a resident violator. So it seems like we're getting into the case where we say the only person that we can detain that's a non-resident or confiscate gear or anything else is if we would deem that violation serious enough to arrest a resident violator. Am I reading that correctly? And the question is, are we passing these guidelines or are we passing the bill? Because the bill says that allow the violator to accept the citation and go on his way without delay. And so I'm concerned that maybe it's the Department of Law that we need, or I'm not sure who we need the answer from, but I'd like to.
Do you want to take a shot at that, or do you have?
I can. Again, Mr. Chair, thank you. I can try to take a shot at that. First off, I think we need to clarify there's a difference between detaining somebody and arresting somebody. And I don't know if that distinction's clear to everybody, but there is a difference. I mean, arresting is taking someone to jail and taking them before a court officer, a magistrate, or a judge. And detaining them sometimes is as simple as sitting there and talking to them to get enough information to fill out a citation. The compact, and I discussed this, it wasn't with Mr. Saxby, but other members of law, under their definitions, because I had the same concerns when I read this, I've, even on my own, I've got written in the margins, does this take away our arrest authority? If you read through, and I don't remember exactly where it is, on page six of the actual bill, under Article 3, what scared me and what may give you concern is it says a wildlife officer shall issue a citation to any person whose primary residence is in a party state in the same manner, and that's the key, in the same manner as if the person were a resident of the home state. We have arrest authority of people who are members of our home state, and we do sometimes arrest residents of the state. Sometimes it's for serious violations that we arrest them. Sometimes it's because it's a misdemeanor crime and they fail to sign the summons. If they don't give us a promise to appear, we can arrest them. The compact is trying to or is not differentiating residents from non-residents. Treat them the same is what the compact, you know, is the short answer. I think that comes there. Also of what was a little concern to me that I did some further research on, but the compact does address it, is they do differentiate between posting collateral. On page two it talks, in most instances a person who is cited for wildlife violation of state other than the person's home state must post collateral bond. If unable to post collateral bond, is taken to custody until a collateral bond is posted, which is kind of what we do, you know, what I described earlier, what we sometimes are forced to do now. There, under, and it wasn't under their definitions, it was further back in the bill, I believe.
Does that answer your question, you think?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess my problem is that again, returning, and of course, I'm coming from the fisheries standpoint and the fisheries violations that we have. It seems to me that this exemption on in section six that says this violation not covered if it's deemed serious enough to arrest a resident violator, I don't think that we're arresting a lot of commercial fishermen, resident commercial fishermen, and so my question is, this is very unclear that we can detain or that we can require posting a bond or even that we can confiscate a catch of a non-resident when this says that the violator may continue immediately on his way if he agrees to comply with the terms of the citation. And, you know, our situation is somewhat unique in this state with the commercial fisheries and the way we enforce those laws. And so I just want to make sure that we clarify in here, because I don't think the clarification in Section 6 gets us there, but maybe law can tell us a little.
Kevin, can you address that a little bit? Or are you up to speed on the question?
I can a little bit, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, first of all, when I was talking earlier about the collateral or the bond requirement, I wasn't intending to suggest in any way that the power to arrest had been affected by this. Those are two different things. If the troopers decide not to arrest someone, then that's when this language kicks in about not being able to require the person to post collateral. But they certainly, in my opinion, still have all the powers to arrest that they would have had without this compact. The second question was, or the second issue was about, my mind just went blank.
Yep.
Remind me, please.
One second, Kevin. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Ask law if we would insert on page 3, section C there, after line 19, something like, however, nothing in this paragraph prevents the state from requiring bonds, confiscation of equipment, or similar restraints as deemed necessary in commercial fishing cases. Would that be enough clarification that it gets us beyond the problem that we're identifying?
Some language like that might be worth really thinking about, and I'm glad you just reminded me. I was going to point out that when we do seize a vessel or the contents of the vessel, the action is brought against the vessel itself. The vessel is actually treated like a person. There's a complaint essentially filed against the vessel or the catch. And so it isn't necessarily a worry that we wouldn't be able to reach the vessel. And that's not the same as requiring a person to post collateral in order for them to leave, because the complaint is actually brought against the vessel itself. But it still might be worth looking into some clarifying language like that.
Okay. And we will. There is one cleanup amendment that we'll need to do, and certainly entertain that. I certainly have no problem with clarifying that. I wrote down a note to make sure we do it anyway.
Thank you,
any additional questions for Mr. Waldron?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Is it your intent to move this bill out today?
It is my intent to move this bill out today.
May I ask why the hurry?
We are in a 90-day session.
Well,
Do I say more?
Yeah.
Well, let me just, if I can follow up on that.
If you have some serious concerns that we cannot address today, certainly I'm not going to let a piece of legislation that is suspect out of the committee. It would be my desire to move it out, but I certainly am not going to force that on the committee if something comes up that we cannot fix here today.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to bring that point forward because I'm hearing questions from the captain here about the possible contents of the bill. I'm hearing questions from one of the members in terms of the fishing side of the bill, and I think it's a good bill. You know, I'm pretty sure I'm going to support it along the way, but I would really like the opportunity to learn a little bit more about the further implications of the bill itself. I really appreciate your staff bringing forward the binder. I think the presentation was excellent, but as I sit here and learn about the bill, I'm hearing questions that I don't feel are being properly answered in order for us to pass this on to a finance committee, which in a 90-day session is even more busy and more occupied than this committee is.
And we'll get more and more busy as we go along, and that's kind of the reason to get it to them as quickly as possible before the budget kicks in. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess I share the Representative Edgeman's concerns, and I was surprised to see that there's not a judiciary referral whether it's a finance referral. I know that we've got 2-0 fiscal notes, and I guess I'm just wondering if judiciary is an appropriate place, because most of the questions that we have dealing with the multi-state compact have been legal in nature. You don't want it to go to judiciary on a 9-day session. I understand that.
My concern about it going to judiciary is it picking up that fiscal note and then having the third committee. I mean, that's the reality of it.
The Senate.
And then we have the other body to deal with. I'm certainly not going to ram this bill down the committee's throat.
Okay.
If there are concerns that you do not think can be answered during this meeting, I certainly am not going to do that. I will certainly entertain suggestion from the members, and I think yours are duly noted. There are other members of the committee, however. With that, any other questions for Mr. Waldron? Thank you, Mr. Waldron. I would like to open it now to public testimony, and I think we have online Robert Fithian. Robert,
yes.
Are you online?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Resources Committee. This is Robert Fithian, Executive Director of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. I'm testifying from my home in Lower Tonzina, Alaska, in the Copper River Basin. The Alaska Professional Hunters Association supports this bill, and we support the continued formation of this compact group. We encourage this committee to support the bill. We have a couple of concerns. The Alaska Professional Hunters Association has a similar policy regarding membership. All applicants for membership as professional guides into our organization have to sign a statement say they have no pending hunting or guiding convictions, charges, etc., in Alaska, in any other state, or from any other country. And we've had complications in trying to delve into that and find out whether we can find historical data to support their membership statements. But we have two concerns with the bill, and we trust that the bill's sponsor will address them as the bill moves forward. First of all, we want to make sure that the bill protects innocent parties, and I've heard a lot of good comments today from Mr. Kane, Captain Waldron, Mr. Saxby. They've addressed a lot of our concerns, but if person is involved in an incident where they don't break a law but follow the letter of the law to expose the incident. In Alaska, if somebody mistakenly harvests an animal and a bullet travels through the animal and hits another animal that they never saw, and they follow the letter of the law and turn that animal in, when they turn the animal in Alaska, that's considered an act of guilt, and more times than not, they're cited. And once they leave the state, it's much easier for them to plead guilty to something and pay the fine than it is to come back up and prove their innocence. So we want to make sure that that the bill does, in fact, protect the innocent in those regards. And regarding federal law, one issue we've had continuously pop up within the professional guide industry is if somebody's convicted of a federal hunting, fishing, guiding violation, it doesn't always show up in relationship to their state record. And oftentimes, even in Alaska, people are able to get their professional guide license having convictions on the federal side of things that we were not able to intercept through the application process. And those are our only two concerns, and I trust that you've got a great team working on this, and I trust that they wouldn't consider moving the bill and passing it without addressing those type of concerns, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Robert. I appreciate that. We have spent a lot of time discussing some situations where people have mistakenly done things and abided by the letter of the law, and those were concerns that I share as well, so we will continue to look at those. Is there anyone else online to testify, or anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? At this point, I don't think I will close public testimony, because I think that if it is the decision of this body not to move this today, that I would like to leave it open, because I think there are a lot more people who do support this that will be testifying if when the opportunity avails itself. I appreciate, is there anything else, any further debate about this bill at this time? Representative Seaton?
Were you about to close?
Well, I was not going to close public testimony. I was going to leave it open because I do not think that there is the will to move this bill today.
Well, are we in committee discussion?
We now? Are in committee discussion now.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment.
Okay.
And it's being distributed right now.
Okay.
Sorry.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if you, I'll just wait a moment while it gets distributed to all the members.
So would you like to move amendment number one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move conceptual amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is addressing the issue that we talked with law about, and this is labeled as a conceptual amendment, so it could be put in the appropriate place with appropriate wording. But just to repeat it now, it's offering at on page 3 at line 19 at the end of that sentence. It would insert, however, nothing in this paragraph prevents the state from requiring bonds, confiscation of equipment, or similar restraints as determined necessary in commercial fishing cases.
Is there any discussion? Representative Gutenberg.
Just a question. In the nature of adopting this compact, if we amend the compact and it's inconsistent with the larger issue of the compact, what happens? And unfortunately, I don't think there's anybody here that can address that, but
we're not amending the compact, but I also we've heard that this is language that, although I agree with wholeheartedly, is really not necessary because we're not giving up any rights to do this in the first place. It's just clarifying language, and I don't think that would affect this at all. But if Mr. Kane has some comments different than that, I'd appreciate hearing them. Al, are you still online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman, and I don't have anything different. We do need to do a little more research on how other states apply this and how the manual applies, because this same concept also applies to very serious hunting violations. I would assume the troopers would still have the authority to seize a four-wheeler or a hunting rifle or something that was used in a serious wanton waste case. And I also have a question and need to refer to the manual and do a little bit more research, but this is a very good question and we need to clarify it.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
A question to the maker of the motion, and I think the answer is obvious, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do we need to put in Alaska at the end of the statement? Is that what you're attempting to say, though, or is it is you know would be obviously understood? I mean, this is obviously Alaska statutes and so forth. Or
Representative Seaton?
And Mr. Chairman, yes, that's the intent, and where I say the state, I mean the state of Alaska, and PFOR violations in the state. If it's necessary, I think that Ledge Legal probably in their conceptual stage. But
it is a conceptual amendment, so there is a certain amount of.
And Mr. Chairman, I would like to say that there's to the response from legal. You know, I don't have any opposition to expanding this into the hunting arena, but I'm not well enough aware of what those situations are. So, you know,
I believe the comment was from fishing game and not legal, so I'm not sure what they would have to say about it, but we can certainly entertain that. We will be doing hearing this again.
And Mr. Chairman, I would like to say that, you know, I think that legal is telling us that this says that we cannot force somebody to post collateral unless it was a situation in which we would have arrested a resident. So as soon as it's not an arresting a resident offense, the compact for our agreement, the way we have this, is we will not have a non-resident post collateral. And if there is a non-resident commercial fisherman, I think I have some disagreement with the idea of taking the vessel and treating the vessel's catch, because the catch becomes the owner, I mean, the fish become the property of the commercial fisherman with the commercial fishing permit. It does not become the property of the vessel. The vessel is an independent, you know, kind of person, but the vessel doesn't own the fish. The permit holder owns the fish, and not until they come out of the water under our constitution. So I think that we need to get some, I mean, for the purposes of this, I think this language solves our problem, but I don't think that I fully agree with the idea that who owns the catch is the person that has the permit to harvest those fish, not the vessel.
Thank you, and I think that's a discussion for another bill at another time. But
that's correct.
I think this amendment solves the immediate problem for this piece of this bill.
Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on conceptual amendment number one? Then I will remove my objection. Conceptual amendment number one passes. There also is in your packet a little bit of cleanup language, which is amendment number two.
Where?
I think, don't you have it? Have you distributed it? I'm sorry. And just because we're doing these amendments now does not mean that we won't be able to take them up later, but we will be able to get a clean bill to look at. Basically, I'd like to move amendment number two.
Object.
Thank you. The difficulty with this, and it came to our attention that the residency requirement for to get a fishing game license is 12 months, so there's this limbo period for resident. So if you're a resident hunting in the state, there's this limbo period. So we want to remove resident from the language. And if you'll go to page one, line five, I'm on the right place. Page one, line five.
In the title.
A residence license. And it basically just says on a licensee's violation, so it takes out the requirement that you're a resident, because there's that 12-month window where you technically aren't a resident if you have a license. So we're taking out the resident. And on page 10, line 22, we're basically taking out the same thing, and a violator who has, taking out resident and just a violator. To remove the doubt of that period, you have to be here 12 months to get a hunting and fishing license to be considered a resident. So we're just taking that off the table as a potential problem in the future. Is any other discussion about that?
I remember.
Was there another objection? I hear a couple of objections.
I just had a comment.
Representative Rose.
Question.
I'll let you maintain your objection for a brief period.
I guess I read the first one, page one, line five. I guess I read it a little different than you did. I didn't think they were applying for a resident license in the state of Alaska. It's when they applied for a residence license in another state.
The problem comes.
In other words, if they were a resident of the state of Wisconsin, they applied for a license there, they had a violation. Now they're applying for a license here, whether it be a resident or a non-resident license, we wouldn't want it issued. So I read it a little differently.
That's correct, but the problem is that if for a residence to violate in another state, they may not be a resident because they haven't really lived here 12 months, and we kind of leave that window where they may have a license, you know, maybe a non-residence license, they're planning on staying here. And if we leave resident in there, that 12-month window where they're technically not, they may violate within that period and not be allowed to, we may not be able to affect the other state. So it's a resident is what we're looking at. So we're kind of taking resident out of it and just making a violator from any place. So, Representative Seaton?
I guess, just for clarification, my own minder, are we then saying, I mean, we're saying that somebody who has a revocation in another state cannot get a resident or a non-resident license in this state? Is that what we're?
They can't do that. If this bill is enacted, they would not be allowed to do that. What this is for is, and correct me, Mr. Waldron, if I'm explaining this improperly, or if you think you want to take a stab at it. But I think what we're looking at is the 12-month period when someone moves to Alaska. They still have to have a non-resident hunting and fishing license. They violate, if we leave resident in here, there is a potential loophole in here because they weren't a resident that we might not be able to revoke those licenses in the other states. So we're just taking that 12-month window when someone who lives in Alaska violates, maybe with a non-resident license, hunting or fishing license, so that we can file that because they could claim, I wasn't a resident, this doesn't count because the bill said I had to be a resident. So it's that 12-month period for an Alaskan living here who violates where we would be able to go out and get their license revoked in the other states. Does that make sense? This is at the request of law, and I'm not sure I understand it as well as I should, but there's a 12-month window in there where you're really not a resident for hunting and fishing purposes, even though you can vote and everything else. So. Any additional discussion on this amendment? Representative Fairclough, would you like to maintain your objection?
No, I'll remove my objection.
Thank you. No further discussion. Amendment number 2 passes. Is there any other discussion on the bill that we would like to take up at this time, or would we like to wait for a future scheduling to continue after you've had a little more research? Representative Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to put on the record that painfully I've been involved in an LLC formation from the ground up, and this is similar to an LLC in that we don't have the ability to change what the compact language is. There is an existing system that we can become a member of that could help increase the protection of wildlife in Alaska, and wildlife is defined inside the compact and inside of Alaska state statute. And as I understand it, just for clarity purposes on the record, that to address Representative Seaton, we are passing a bill, a House Bill 267, that is bringing us into a partnership that the compact has already outlined. And we are protected inside of that compact outline inside of the statute. And I highlighted it. In that they can't change the compact. If you go to page 9, under Article 9, on line 31, and when we talked about we're only one of many inside of the compact, everyone has to agree inside the compact for a rule to change. So we're not at risk of something changing inside of what we're buying into with one vote. So that was said earlier. So if you think of this as joining in or buying a piece of an already existing LLC, That's our role in how we look at this, and I believe that is why it's not going to judiciary. This is saying that we accept the rules, but that we maintain our own sovereignty as a state in everything we do, that we judge that particular violator inside of our own court system, and that they go through a judicial process to measure against Alaska law on every case. But if that's not correct, I would like to hear more about that from our law department. I'm ready to advance it forward, but certainly, as the chair has recommended, wouldn't want other people to be uncomfortable with that. And I'm only comfortable because I was painstakingly through this process within the last 2 years of participating in the formation of an LLC. With that,
I would certainly not be opposed to moving it forward, but I also respect the other members of this committee greatly. And am hesitant to run roughshod over other members who have questions. Although I think I do think it could go, because I think the questions could be answered, and I'm committed to making it better. I certainly am not going to force this forward. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I think that we need to recognize that the load with the 90-day session that's happening on finance, you know, my feeling is that finance is probably going to look at fiscal notes or finance implications of this, and so that if you want to get some changes in this, I think that here is the best place to do it.
So, I certainly, and that also weighs into my decision. I would like to get them a bill that's as clean and ready to go as they could possibly have, and I don't want any of those questions to have to be answered there. They are a bigger committee, and if this one is unwieldy, that one is even worse. So certainly don't want to go there. So it is my intention not to move this today, but I do intend to move it as quickly as possible to get it up before the budget subcommittees and the budget hits, all the pipeline stuff that we're going to have. So this will be up very quickly at at possibly the next hearing. So I would encourage everyone to formulate their questions, work with Jeannie in my office, so that when we come back next time, if we aren't singing off the same page, at least we can know where everyone stands, and then you can sign the referral any way you choose. So I'd like you to do that sooner than later. And, you know, tomorrow, this afternoon is good for me because I'm anxious to get this going. I think we heard testimony that there have been people in the department waiting this for over 10 years. When I saw this, I couldn't believe it hadn't already been done. When I testified before the department, or the fish board and the game board, they were amazed that it hadn't been done and that we weren't members of it. They endorsed it heartily. We've heard from all the user, or most of the user groups. We will be hearing from more of them, stating that it is supported. So this is a concept, and Bill, whose time has come, I want it to be right when it goes. So I would appreciate the work. We're all busy, but it is something that I will intend to advance in our next meeting, and would like your cooperation in getting your questions and comments in advance of that, so that we can sing off the same page, or at least agree to disagree. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only other piece of information that might be helpful if we're going to revisit this for me would be actual experience from the other states that have been in the compact already. So not necessarily the original three, but we do have many states that have experienced this, and some of the questions or trepidation might be able to be answered if we talk to people that are already in the system, and maybe the chairman has already done that.
Representative Faircloth, someone from the Outdoor Council who called today and wanted to testify on it, but they discussed it last night in a meeting and will be voting whether or not totally supported. There's a member who has worked with a number of other states who they've recommended to testify. They recommended, of course, in the next hearing, but they will certainly be in this venue. So I think some of those questions with the experience who spent a lot of time working with other states and finding out if this works or not, will be available to testify. They will not be from other states, although I think we could probably arrange some to do that. So I certainly would encourage, or certainly do, will be making some of those phone calls.
Yeah, and along that, I agree with her.
Representative Greenberg, would you have something?
Yes. thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with
Gutenberg, I'm sorry.
Representative Faircloth. I'd like to see somebody's opinion from some another state, mm-hmm. not some necessarily somebody that from our state that's working
right.
with them, but.
Certainly, we can certainly get some of those in there. And if you'd have a recommendation, because I could pick one that's going to be favorable, or would like to work with the office, I could probably get a bunch of them to say yes. But.
Well, I hope they will all say yes, but I would just like to hear about their experiences.
Right. Okay, excellent. Any additional questions, comments, or any other business to come before Representative Rosen?
Just a quick comment. I support the concept of it. The only issue or concern that I think we need to bring forward if we're having before is if any of the committee members still have questions about the legal aspect of it or the concerns that they may have about the state's rights issues that are involved in here. I'd certainly like to get some clarification of that. That's the only part that I have any concern over.
From legal? Yeah.
Okay. If there's still pending issues or pending legal concerns anybody has, if we can get this.
I certainly will line up all the appropriate people to testify and answer questions. It would be a great help to me in lining up people from other states if I would have that well in advance of our next meeting. So the sooner the better. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The person who testified talked about protection of innocent parties, so I hope that your staff has that one as well as the federal level. And I'm not sure how we incorporate the federal level into this if they don't already provide it to the compact. It's going to be difficult for us to come up with a way that we can merge a system that isn't merged already inside of the other states. So
they listen to us so much.
I understand that. I know that I'm being eternally optimistic. I just don't know how we can address that concern, but I definitely heard it. And I don't know if there's a centralized spot at a federal level or if there's any movement of the compact, if we should become engaged with the compact to actually bring in the federal violations and entertain them actually into the compact in some way to provide information for download to all states.
And I also, if I heard Mr. Fithian's question or statement properly, is they have some trouble recognizing federal offenses when they license guides. I don't know that we can assist them in that, but what we can assist them in is the 26 other states. You know, and chances are if they violated federal law, hopefully, I don't want to say hopefully because I don't like violators, but there's a chance that maybe they violated in some of those other states, that we will have an opportunity to follow up, or?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to put on the record that we heard what the person had said, but I believe, I don't know how we can address that at this point inside of the law when it's going to take a federal move to be able to get that incorporated into ours.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if we could hear from Wildlife Protection here as to...
Mr. Waldron.
As to violations on of fish and game regulations on federal lands, and what is the current status of in Alaska? What happens in what jurisdiction does that go through? I mean, would that still result in the possible suspension or of a resident or non-resident's license, even though that's on federal, occurred on federal land?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the federal lands are joint jurisdictional with this state and federal, so it all depends upon which agency chooses or prosecutes the individual, whether it's a state violation or federal violation, and oftentimes both. Certainly, when you know, we have a violation that's serious enough that we ask for a suspension or revocation of someone's privileges. Well, let me backtrack from that a little bit. The history has been the federal government's been less anxious to join the compact because, in their mind, when they revoke someone's hunting privileges, it doesn't matter if it's a compact or not. It's all 50 states. So now getting that data to the 50 states is the issue, and that's, I think, what Mr. Fithian was referring to. It's not entered into any state database such as APSIN that Mr. Representative Kawasaki referred to, and we don't have access to we have access to NCIC, but it's not entered in that either. They have their own, I don't even know what it's called, what their acronym is for their own crimes tracking database. So the convictions may be there on a federal level, and the license revocations may be there on a federal level, but often we don't know about it.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to figure out. I mean, people go hunting up here all the time, and I'm not sure that they get anything other than the state hunting and fishing license. Is there a federal hunting or fishing license that is, other than, you know, the EEZ or the exclusive economic zone of federal jurisdiction off the coast? I mean, the license that is there to be revoked is a state hunting license, isn't it?
Representative Seaton, that's correct. There is the federal government does not issue any kind of hunting or fishing or commercial fishing licenses in Alaska.
So,
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So maybe the issue as far as this bill's going is academic anyway versus a guiding license or something, but I mean, unless the military on military reservation is getting a state hunting or fishing license, aren't they?
They are.
So
in most, I can't say all, so I'll say most of the Department of Defense wildlife enforcement officers have limited state commissions to enforce, so they're enforcing state laws on the military bases. That's not always the case, but people are hunting on state hunting licenses or state fishing licenses.
Representative,
I just had one other question. We talked about suspension or revocation, and this bill only deals with revoked licenses, doesn't it, or does it also deal with suspension of licenses?
Specifically, it only addresses revocations.
And can you give us some, Mr. Chairman?
Representative,
can you give us some kind of proportionality of what numbers of licenses in the state we suspend and what number we revoke, or just give us some semblance of the idea of what we're talking about here?
Any case that I've been involved in or any case that I'm aware of, we've never suspended someone's hunting privileges. They've always been revoked.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Any additional discussions or any further business to come before the committee? I'd like to thank you for attending. I know you've come down for this, and maybe we can get you on the phone next week sometime and for additional questions. Mr. Kane, I appreciate you taking a break from your meeting and attending long distance. And I appreciate the indulgence of the committee and do encourage you to get the information as quickly as possible. I see Bryce is trying to leave, so I'm stretching down. So with that, we will adjourn. Thanks, everyone, for attending.